Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, May 30th, 2014. For many Americans, just an ordinary payday. But in Washington,
it's quitting time, quitting time. Time to disassemble, it's assembly line. Lord, I love punching out.
Not surprisingly, Eric Shinseki, a general who I admire, has resigned his post as the cabinet secretary in charge of the Department of Veterans Affairs. And the heat had been building. Yesterday, I made the prediction that he would be going soon. And actually, when it didn't happen yesterday, I thought, well, maybe they'll bury it with the 5 p.m. dump. But no, after he gave a speech to a veterans group in Washington this morning and apologized for the mess at the VA, he was summoned to the White House, where President Obama accepted his resignation, allegedly with regret. And as I mentioned yesterday, I don't think Shinseki is really responsible for the systemic problems at the Veterans Administration, and I fault Congress for failing to provide the money and the oversight to provide for the troops that they knew were coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan. It is beyond shameful. And yet, we will see Republicans try to score political points on this issue over the next few months, trying to manipulate veterans into voting for them as if their obstruction isn't one of the major causes of the huge backlogs and the service problems they have over at the VA. So that was the expected resignation today. But there was another one.
It's quitting time, quitting time. Time to disassemble, it's assembly line.
And I don't know if Keith Whitley is popular at the White House, but I was surprised when I popped up the New York Times website this morning and found out that Jay Carney, the press secretary, has decided to step down. He hasn't said when his last day of work will be. But the president joined him in the press room to thank him for his service as a spinmeister and to announce that Josh Earnest, the deputy press secretary, will take his place. And Earnest has been before the press before. It's been kind of uneven. But with a name like Earnest, right, you got to believe him. And Jay Carney was in this post, what, for 3.5 years? He came over from Time magazine, where he was a pretty respected journalist, and inside the Beltway guy, to be fair. And then he turned into a different animal, as press secretaries must. It's a thankless job. You are there to prevent the disclosure of information that your boss says he doesn't want released. And they don't care what it takes to prevent the release of that information that the media wants. And so I don't envy anyone who takes the job. But all you have to do is look at the people who've had it before and the roles they've played and the manner in which they have had to keep the pack of dogs at bay. And you wonder why anybody would ever take that job. Well, once you survive it, the revolving door will take care of you. We'll see Jay Carney showing up as a pundit on a cable television channel. He might be offered a position at a stink tank somewhere. So, there he goes, Jay Carney. Last night, I got to catch up with the NBC News interview with Ed Snowden, conducted by Brian Williams in Moscow. And by the way, it's on my Comcast On Demand panel. It was very easy to find. It had its own button there. So NBC clearly wants to get a lot of mileage out of not only the live broadcast on Wednesday night, but it's going to be replayed on Friday night on MSDNC. And it was a very interesting interview. I came away so impressed with Ed Snowden, a very smart man for all of his 29, or maybe he's turned 30 now. And he did not buckle under the questioning of Brian Williams, who was alternately hostile. And the way the interview was packaged, you know, with the promos and is he a traitor? It was really stacked against Ed Snowden. And despite that, in the middle two segments, he really held forth, and Brian Williams, I think, was surprised and stunned. Williams tried at some points to kind of play the government line about security over privacy and freedom. And Snowden didn't take it. And he explained that he had been an undercover spy for the CIA and for the NSA. And he also said that he repeatedly went to superiors and even sent emails to NSA HQ at Fort Meade. That was immediately challenged by John Kerry, Secretary of State, and others in the Obama administration. And the White House didn't want to release the single memo that the NSA is able to find from Ed Snowden. And they're claiming that because they can only find one, that he's probably shading the truth or not telling the truth because he said that there were more than one. But I don't have any confidence that the NSA can find things in the mountains of data that they have collected on innocent people, much less the prime suspect in the biggest leak the agency has ever endured. And so the White House was still fidgeting over this, and Dianne Feinstein, my senator, it's painful to say that, my senior senator from California, and chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, she took it upon herself to declassify it and release what she says is the only memo they have from Ed Snowden. Now, the memo itself is a little cryptic. It doesn't say, you know, if you guys don't stop spying on innocent Americans, I'm going to go to Glenn Greenwald. But the memo that they have released, the email, asks a direct question about the rank order of statutes, executive orders, and the U.S. Constitution. And what Snowden was clearly trying to discover was whether, as he felt, that there were inappropriate authorities being given to NSA employees that were not lawful. And so his question about whether executive orders can override a statute suggests that he was trying to figure out on what basis his agency, he was at that point a contractor at Booz Allen Hamilton in Hawaii, but, you know, did the NSA have the legal authority to collect all this information on innocent people? And so Feinstein and the NSA apologists all say, well, hey, he said there were a bunch of these emails. There's only one. And in it, he doesn't even ask a pointed question about whether, say, the PRISM program was legal. Well, again, in their attempts to reconstruct and rewrite history, the NSA apologists want to minimize and marginalize Ed Snowden. And I think in his interview with Brian Williams that he showed himself to be a substantial person, somebody who thought through what he was about to do. I still maintain he will never be regarded as the world's greatest fugitive. But to me, that doesn't detract from the important contributions he has made to sounding the alarm to the American people that we have been under constant, pervasive surveillance by our government in clear violation of the Constitution. Ed Snowden knows that. And so do the people who attack him. They know what the Constitution says. They are spinning, deceiving, manipulating, and lying. And while Ed Snowden isn't perfect, and there are a lot of questions you can raise about what he put in motion, the trust that he put into Glenn Greenwald and others, the role of Pierre Omidyar, the eBay founder who runs the startup company that Greenwald works for now. Yeah, there are questions there. I don't dodge that at all. But for me, the results of what Snowden has put in motion and the risks that he took have helped substantiate the whistleblower claims that I have been bringing to you from other voices for many years now. And for that, I will always be grateful to Edward Snowden. I'm also grateful to the people who support this podcast and send me subscription money every month. Deborah Kennedy, Diane Morris, Bernice Del Orto, Dan Shannon, among the many who voluntarily support this program by subscribing. I hope you'll join them. Go to peterbcollins.com, right under my picture on the homepage. The link says sign up. Takes you to a page where you have choices. $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. The best deals are $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers located in the U.S. qualify for our bonus gifts. Currently, the rock and roll CD called Red Flag by our friend John Dist in Los Angeles, and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans from our friend Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. I hope you will join us today and help keep this whole effort going. One of the things that's really missing in this country is a federal shield law for journalists. Most of the states, I think 49, have state-level laws that protect journalists from having to reveal confidential sources. There is no federal shield law. And that's why James Risen of the New York Times continues to battle the Justice Department, which is demanding that he reveal his sources. And he is refusing. Well, Alan Grayson, the fiery Democrat, member of Congress from Florida, managed to insert and pass an amendment in the House last night. And I am really floored by this and very pleased. Now, it's only a start, but what he did was insert a brief one-sentence amendment to the bill that provides funding for the Department of Justice. And it reads, "None of the funds made available by this act may be used to compel a journalist or reporter to testify about information or sources that the journalist or reporter states in a motion to quash the subpoena that he has obtained as a journalist or reporter and that he regards as confidential." It passed in the House. Yeah, I mean, Republicans control the House, and this bill passed on a 225 to 183 vote after midnight last night. Now, there's a lot more work to be done because there's no definition of who qualifies as a journalist in this case. And we were just talking about Glenn Greenwald, who currently works for an independent outlet called The Intercept. Is that covered by this? Are bloggers covered? Are podcasters like me covered? Well, this language is very broad. And it would be up to a court to determine who is actually covered by it. Now, Grayson acknowledges that this is the start. It paves the way for the first federal shield law. And my friend Norman Solomon wrote a great comment piece, I think it's at commondreams.org today, about the Risen case and about the Obama administration's crackdown on leakers and the journalists that they leak to. This is a very important issue. And Alan Grayson is the kind of persistent, dogged, and resourceful member of Congress. And I wasn't watching C-SPAN last night, so I don't know how all of this transpired. But he cleverly inserted this at a key moment and got it passed. And that's not all. Imagine my surprise when I got this press release this morning that yesterday the House of Representatives passed the Hinchey-Rohrabacher Medical Marijuana Amendment. This, too, restricts the Department of Justice from using funds to raid, arrest, or prosecute medical marijuana patients and providers in states where medical marijuana is legal. Now, this is really significant because Congress has been unwilling to do what it should do, which is to reschedule marijuana down from Schedule 1 on the drug restriction roster. And if they did that, then federal authorities would not have the what they consider to be the compelling authority to mess with medical marijuana distribution. And in the first Obama term, for the first 3 years, things were going well. There was a kind of don't ask, don't tell approach. And the feds were holding back from any prosecution of legal medical marijuana providers. But as he geared up for re-election, Obama called in the dogs. And the crackdown has been widespread and quite extreme. Now, one of the fiery people who is a staunch member of the medical marijuana community is Steve D'Angelo. And he's the CEO at the Harborside Health Center in Oakland, one of the largest medical pot dispensaries in the country. And they have been in the sights of the federal prosecutors now for the last 2 or 3 years. They, for example, have been told that all of their expenses cannot be deducted from their gross revenues, so that every dollar that comes in is taxable. And in any other kind of business, you get to deduct the cost of your payroll, the cost of rent, the cost of overhead, all of your expenses before you declare a net profit and pay taxes on that. But marijuana dispensaries have been singled out for this zero deduction approach. And that's just another way that the government has been squeezing them. They've also cracked down on dispensaries that are in rental property by going after the landlords and telling them that they're going to forfeit their property if they don't cancel the lease to the medical marijuana dispensary. Now, in the case of Harborside, I'm pretty sure they own their own building and are not subject to that kind of a tactic. But I want to read you some comments here from a press release from Steve D'Angelo. He said, "The passage of the Hinchey-Rohrabacher Amendment was no accident. This has been one of the central goals of the medical cannabis movement for almost 20 years. Its passage is a clear sign of our movement's growing political sophistication and potency. Prohibitionists who predicted that the stoners would just lose motivation and forget about it have been proven decisively wrong. With public opinion polls showing overwhelmingly bipartisan support for medical cannabis nationwide and some sort of medical cannabis laws passed in half the states, even Florida and Georgia, those politicians feckless enough to resist the tide are rapidly running out of places to hide." He says that it's now time for the functionaries of our democracy to wake up and smell the cannabis. And then he singles out some of the people who are his nemesis. Anti-scientific bureaucrats like DEA Administrator Michelle Leonhardt, who can't tell the difference between heroin and cannabis, should either take some lessons at Oaksterdam University or do the decent thing and resign. U.S. attorneys like Melinda Hogg in the Northern District of California and Ben Wagner in the Eastern District of California, who continue to prosecute state legal medical cannabis providers, should either drop those actions or be fired by the Attorney General for insubordination. I've requested an interview with Steve. If we can make that happen, we'll get it to you next week here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. Just over 2 weeks ago, we released one of our in-depth interviews to subscribers, which now is available to all. It's unrestricted. And it featured Dr. Richard Horowitz, an established expert and an author who knows a lot about Lyme disease. The other guest was Andy Abrahams Wilson, the filmmaker who produced a powerful documentary 5 years ago called Under Our Skin. And today, Jessica Bernstein at Truth Out, and I'll link to her story in the show file for this podcast, reports that there are people who are suffering with chronic Lyme conditions, and they've had enough. And they have adopted some of the tactics that were used by AIDS activists. You remember ACT UP? And so they zeroed in on the group called the Infectious Diseases Society of America. And this is a group that has been following the issues related to Lyme for many years now. And Dr. Horowitz himself said that IDSA is a pretty good group. But some of the activists led by Josh Cutler, who has been carrying the Lyme virus for more than 10 years now, he's disabled, hasn't been able to work for 5 years. Well, he organized a group of people who went to the headquarters in Arlington, Virginia this week. I'm sorry, it was a week ago, May 22nd and 23rd. Hundreds of irate Lyme patients led by this guy are protesting in front of the IDSA headquarters. In the tradition of ACT UP, the AIDS activist movement, they took to the streets outside the IDSA building demanding changes in diagnostic criteria and treatment protocols. Sick patients descended on the place that became the office for these dinner parties where the group originated and conducted die-ins, with protesters laying their bodies on the ground in order to block the entrance. Many of the protesters were in wheelchairs or stood with IVs. A truck circled the building throughout the day bearing signs that read, "Tell the IDSA to stop rejecting science," and "Patients with chronic Lyme disease are dying. Fight for a cure." So I'm glad to see this kind of activism. And I hope you'll listen to our interview as Dr. Horowitz notes that the Centers for Disease Control last year quietly revised their estimates about the number of people infected with Lyme annually, and they increased it tenfold from 30,000 to 300,000. It's a very serious problem, and the medical establishment has been ignoring it for years. And as you may know, L-Y-M-E, Lyme disease, originated in the town of Lyme, Connecticut. And Richard Blumenthal, who is currently a senator from Connecticut, before that was the attorney general of that state, conducted an investigation in 2006. And he said that the IDSA's Lyme disease guideline panel undercut its credibility by allowing individuals with financial interest in drug companies, in Lyme disease diagnostic tests, patents, and consulting arrangements with insurance companies to exclude divergent medical evidence and opinion. Medical societies that publish such guidelines have a legal and moral duty to use exacting safeguards and scientific standards. So I am just cheering for these activists who have had enough and are no longer going to be polite about it. I just think that's terrific. Well, the New York Times today, if you read between the lines, is exposing a political struggle between the White House and Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. The Obama team wants Hagel to move more swiftly to release prisoners from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And Chuck Hagel, who is empowered by Congress as the sole decision maker to certify that releasing a detainee doesn't pose an undue risk, he is taking his sweet-ass time. And he admits it. He says, "My name is going on that document. That's a big responsibility. What I'm doing is I'm taking my time. I owe that to the American people to ensure that any decision I make is, in my mind, responsible." Well, he's being prodded now because these comments follow in less than a week a memo from Susan Rice, the president's national security advisor, a three-pager, requiring Hagel to provide an update on progress in detainee transfers every 2 weeks until further notice. He's on a very short leash from the White House. They even included attachments showing the history of Obama's guidance on how much risk to accept when transferring prisoners. And so what makes this really callous, heartless, and completely unacceptable is that Hagel, the Republican appointee that Obama put in as Secretary of Defense, is slow walking this process. And meanwhile, Jihad Ahmed Diab is on a hunger strike because he's been cleared for release since 2009 and Chuck Hagel won't let him out. And Diab may end up succeeding in taking his own life because his only available way to protest is to refuse food. And he is the individual who is the subject of the court-ordered forced feeding. despite the fact that Judge Gladys Kessler finds the force feeding to be abominable. And all of this could be fixed if Chuck Hagel would just do his job. There's an offer on the table from Uruguay to accept 6 prisoners from our gulag at Guantanamo. Not clear to me if Diab is one of those. But in the past year, since Obama said he wanted to accelerate the reduction of the population and ultimately close Guantanamo, only 12 men have been released. Only one this year. It's inexcusable. And it's another reason why I continue to scratch my head as to why Barack Obama, after what he went through with Bob Gates, would put another Republican in as defense secretary. And meanwhile, we learned today from the Guardian newspaper in London that one of the ripple effects of Obama's decision to extend U.S. troop deployments in Afghanistan until the end of 2016 is that it buys more time to keep at least 50 prisoners, about whom very little is known, at the Parwan facility adjacent to the Bagram Air Base near Kabul. Now, we've talked about this for years now. If you think Guantanamo is bad, we don't even know the names or the countries of these 50 or so people who are being held indefinitely without charge or trial under our control in Afghanistan. Now, we have some sketchy information about them. We know that they are mostly non-Afghans. We're told that it is believed that this group includes Pakistanis, Yemenis, Tunisians, Uzbeks, and Russians, and that it's made up of people whom the military suspects are tied to extremist groups, including Al-Qaeda. Most are believed to have been either captured in Afghanistan or transferred there by the CIA. So it's a holding place for people who can't go to Guantanamo or can't be brought to civilian prisons and courts in the United States for whatever reasons. The non-Afghans at Parwan in U.S. custody enjoy almost no rights. They receive visits from the International Red Cross. They get occasional phone calls with family members. But beyond that, they are functionally invisible to the outside world. And Obama has been sitting on this secret and maintaining it throughout his entire presidency. And it undermines his laudable efforts to close Guantanamo. Finally today, the government in Egypt is claiming that they had a 46% turnout in the rubber stamp election that is being used to declare a mandate for Field Marshal Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. He's the new Mubarak, the dictator with total control. Because he comes out of the military, he knows that the troops are unlikely to turn on him. Now, they're saying that they had a 46% turnout when most observers there think that even 30% would be an exaggeration. And in many respects, this is, you know, we're fighting over the box scores here. Because the U.S. has not uttered any protest whatsoever about the election, about the way al-Sisi has been presiding over the crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood, the imprisonment of the elected former president, the mass trials with death sentences for hundreds who were accused of being part of a mob where a cop was killed. I mean, this is a brutal military dictatorship that resulted from a coup last July 3rd. And we continue to support this government, send them money, and utter not a single word of criticism. Last night, Secretary of State Kerry gave a 15-minute interview on public television's NewsHour. They covered a whole range of subjects from you know, the problems in Nigeria to Syria to Ukraine, not a word was mentioned about Egypt and about this phony election, which was conducted to try to build some sort of justification internationally for the military dictatorship fully supported by the United States in Egypt today. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. Due to some computer glitches, I cannot access the usual version of Happy Trails that I play. Here is an alternate.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.